Genesis 49 today, the final words of one of the Bible's greatest characters, Jacob, the young deceiver, the lone wanderer who found the God of his father on the desert road. Jacob, who worked 7 years for love, found himself deceived. Jacob, whose whole life was struggle, who wrestled with God and wouldn't let go, who walked in Jacob and walked out Israel, and bore a limp the rest of his days. Jacob, Israel, has reached his final day. Verse 1 begins, "Then Jacob called for his sons and said, 'Gather around so I can tell you what will happen to you in days to come.'" He calls all 12 sons together to tell them what will happen to them. And the last phrase here is important, "in days to come." It's also translated "in the last days." It is used 14 times in the Old Testament. This is the first. And it always refers to prophecies of the future, usually extending into end times. What follows is an extensive prophecy about Jacob's sons and about the nation of Israel as a whole. And with that, we get some hidden gems of Bible prophecy and God's plan for the world. Now, all of this prophecy is delivered through a father's blessing. That's an important Bible concept and a foundational element of culture and tradition historically. A father looking at his children and speaking what he sees in them and what he sees ahead for them. We don't have quite the same practice today, but you can look across culture and across time and see that there is something essential to life in what a father sees in his children and the way he speaks over their lives, a blessing. And when we don't have it, we struggle. We search for a mentor or father figure or for God himself to speak blessing into our lives. Well, we begin in verse 2. "Assemble and listen, sons of Jacob. Listen to your father Israel. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the first sign of my strength, excelling in honor, excelling in power." So Jacob speaks first to Reuben, the firstborn. Tradition would give him the greatest blessing, more inheritance, and more responsibility to lead the family. And indeed, Reuben excelled in honor and power. But in verse 4, "Turbulent as the waters, you will no longer excel, for you went up onto your father's bed, onto my couch, and defiled it." Reuben blew it. He had every opportunity to succeed and to lead his brothers, but he threw it all away when he got in bed with his father's wife, Bilhah, in chapter 35. A. Gross. B. Wrong. And C. Costly. The immediate consequences were not much. But Reuben ruined himself that day. He was first, but look at his descendants. Not one judge, nor priest, nor king, nor prophet would come from his line. The first became last, because one sexual sin can destroy a legacy. Count the cost. Verse 5. "Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence." Recall that it was Simeon and Levi who attacked the Shechemites after the rape of their sister Dinah, a horrific scene, and Jacob did not forget. Verse 7, "Cursed be their anger, so fierce, and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel." Fast forward to the Promised Land, and these two tribes were indeed scattered. Simeon's land was surrounded by Judah, and Levi was dispersed throughout. Now, as we read chapter 49, some scholars see a secondary fulfillment to this prophecy. Prophecy often works that way, having fulfillment in two stages. Here, the more immediate fulfillment will be in the future of each tribe, the descendants of each son. But the secondary fulfillment will be seen in the full timeline of the whole nation of Israel, from its beginning at Mount Sinai all the way to end times. For that, I invite you to listen to the Side B audio. For now, brother number 4 is in verse 8. "Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you." Judah is an interesting character, the man of bending morals. He sold Joseph, had wicked sons, hired a prostitute. But we saw Judah's repentance and redemption as he laid his life down for Benjamin's. And Judah's legacy would be a great one. From Judah comes the humble shepherd king, David, and the entire line of kings. Judah's line would rule, And when the nation split, the southern kingdom would be called Judea, and the people Jews. So that's where we get the word Jewish. Then in verse 9, you are a lion's cub, Judah. Remember that the line of kings leads to Jesus, the lion of the tribe of Judah. Then verse 10 is fascinating. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until... Now, a scepter is a sign of rule held by the king, and that scepter would be held by the line of Judah, by the line of kings from David. Back in verse 10, until he to whom it belongs shall come. So the prophecy says the line of kings under Judah shall remain until he comes. Who is he? The Hebrew word here is Shiloh, and scholars say it's hard to translate. But the Jewish Talmud records many ancient rabbis who interpreted this Shiloh as the Messiah, and they believed that the line of David's kings would rule until Messiah appeared. Mind you, they said this before Messiah. Well, David ruled in about 1000 BC, and his line carried the scepter through to the exile in 600 BC. And even though they were greatly weakened, no longer called kings, the rule remained in the house of Judah through the exile and return, and even under attacks and occupation by Greeks and Romans. For a full millennium, they still held some self-rule, until the year 7 AD. At that time, Rome occupied Judea, and the historian Josephus records that in 7 AD, Caesar Augustus removed the Judean ruler named Archelaus and replaced him with a Roman, and he took away the Jews' right to execute capital punishment. You may recall in the Gospels that the Jews had to go to Pontius Pilate, a Roman, for permission to execute Jesus. In other words, the scepter, the right to rule, had passed from Judah. And the prophecy here tells us that would not happen until Shiloh arrived, the Messiah. And guess who was a young boy in 7 AD? Well, back in the prophecy, Jacob says of this Shiloh, and the obedience of the nations shall be his. Jacob moves on. I'll let you read through Zebulun, Issachar, Dan, and the rest. We'll dig in more on the B side. But I want to skip ahead now to verse 22, as Jacob turns to his son Joseph, our hero in this story. Joseph is a fruitful vine near a spring. Fruitful is truly a blessing, to bear fruit, to do something worthy for God and provide for others. And that was Joseph's story. 23. With bitterness, archers attacked him. Joseph lived under so much attack. But in 24, his bow remained steady. His strong arm stayed limber because of the hand of the mighty one of Jacob, because of the shepherd, the rock of Israel, because of your father's God. This is beautiful. Jacob, who for so long talked about the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, looks at his son and sees God's faithfulness, and he understands that it was the mighty one of Jacob, the rock of Israel, that God was his God, his rock, and that his God had truly blessed his son with blessings of the skies above, blessings of the deep springs below. Again, there is so much more here. Please read it through. And check out the B-side for more. And when it's all done, Jacob gives his sons a command. I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave in the field of Ephron. And so with his final request, Jacob delivers a reminder to his kids that Egypt is not their home. 33. When Jacob had finished giving instructions to his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people.
Join us next time as we continue the journey, one chapter at a time. And remember, faith comes by hearing, and hearing through the word.